Back again to badquaker.com podcast. Today is Thursday, August 16th, 2012, and this is podcast number 188. My name is Ben Stone, and I have a very special guest today, Kevin Gutzman. Kevin is a New York Times best-selling author of four books, a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University. He holds a law degree from the University of Texas at Austin, as well as an MA and a PhD in American history from the University of Virginia. Plus, he's got writings all over the internet. He's has had a ton of interviews, TV, radio, all around. He's a real contributor to the Liberty Movement. And in addition to that, he works with Tom Woods in the Liberty Classroom that you've heard me talking so much about. So without any more, I'm going to just jump right into the interview with Kevin and let you hear Kevin for him in his own words.
With me is Kevin Gutzman, and you're probably going to know him from any of several books that we're going to mention here. James Madison and the Making of America is his most recent book. The book that that I really became aware of, Kevin, is The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, and he also wrote Virginia's American Revolution, and another one that I have is Who Killed the Constitution? Kevin, welcome to badquaker.com, welcome to the show, and I really appreciate you coming on with me and sharing your thoughts tonight.
I'm happy to be here.
I did want to ask you, first off, since this is your latest book, James Madison and the Making of America, I haven't read it yet, so please tell me why I should buy it and what's in there, and tell me what my audience is going to want to hear about it.
Well, let me ask you first, have you read anything about Madison?
Not a whole lot, actually, about James Madison. It's kind of a blank area for me.
Okay, well then, I'll give you a kind of beginner's tour through his life and then try to tell you how my book is different from what you'd get from other people. In general, what happened is that in 1994, I wrote an essay about Madison and the nullification crisis. I had the idea that I might want to write a PhD dissertation about John C. Calhoun, and I asked my advisor, well, what could I do for an MA thesis that would be a kind of introduction or background to Calhoun? And he said, well, why don't you take a look at Madison in 1798? And of course, in 1798, Madison and Jefferson promulgated what are called the Virginia and Kentucky Resolutions, mm-hmm. where they laid out the state-centered understanding of the Constitution that came to be central to the Jeffersonian Republican Party's platform for a quarter century after that. And so, in looking at Madison in 1798, I found that essentially what he had done in the nullification crisis in 1832 and 33 was to mischaracterize the position he had taken in 1798. So essentially in 1798 what had happened was that Congress had passed a law called the Sedition Act, signed by President Adams into law on Bastille Day 1798. And that law had made it, among other things, a crime to say anything that tended to bring the government into ill repute. This was not purely theoretical. 25 people were prosecuted under the Sedition Act, and 10 of them, including a congressman from Vermont, were thrown into prison or given substantial fines, or in most cases both, for saying negative things about President Adams, and especially his foreign policy. And so what Jefferson and Madison did in the Virginia and Kentucky Resolutions of 1798 was to say the states created the federal government, they gave it a few powers. In case the federal government adopts policies that are unconstitutional and dangerous, and these are the words of the Virginia Resolutions that were written by Madison, the states have the right and are in duty bound to interpose. So, in 1832 and 33, the South Carolina line of nullifiers did exactly that. They said that the protective tariff adopted by Congress in 1824, then raised in 1828, and raised still higher in 1832, was unconstitutional and dangerous, and so they were going to interpose, the Carolinians were going to interpose, to prevent the enforcement of the tariff within South Carolina. Well, Madison, in 1832 and 33, could have said, you know, in 1798, the issue of the Sedition Act was whether you could have a free election, because if you can't criticize incumbents, you can't have an election, and so really that was about Republican government. On the other hand, what you're arguing about here is the protective tariff, which actually is constitutional, and so you shouldn't be nullifying it. But instead, what Madison said in 1832 and 33 was, well, no, back in 1798, we never claimed that an individual state could stand up to the federal government. And what I found was that despite what all the historians who had written about Madison had said, Madison's argument in 1832 was just flat untrue. And so, as I said, I wrote this this journal article. It was published in a leading scholarly journal in my field. And after that, writing, as you said, a book about Virginia in the era of the Revolution down to about 1840, and a book about the Constitution and various other things, I kept kind of having my projects intersect with Madison. And every time Madison would come up, what I found about him from looking at the primary materials was inconsistent with what historians were saying about him. And finally, when I had six or seven major points in his career where I thought that the kind of accepted version of Madison was incorrect, I realized I'm going to have to write a book about Madison to lay all these out. And so let me give you a kind of idea of who Madison is, why you should care, and then how my account of him is different from what other people have said. Madison was the most important person in the American invention of written constitutions. And in fact, the first political office he held was as a delegate to what was called the Virginia Convention in 1776. And what he was 25 years old. He was the youngest man in the body. And what he was involved in doing was writing the first written constitution adopted by the people's representatives in the history of the world. And not only that, but he played an important role in doing that. And then after that, of course, famously, he was in Congress in the 1780s, and there he became convinced that the central government in the Revolution was just too weak. It couldn't pay the soldiers, it couldn't raise the army, it couldn't even pay to have embassies abroad, and so on. And so he decided there needed to be a new federal constitution. The Articles of Confederation were inadequate, and so he played one of the three or four leading roles in bringing the Philadelphia Convention that wrote the Constitution into being. And then in Philadelphia, Madison made an important proposal, what was called the Virginia Plan, really more or less Madison's plan, about an alternative to the Articles of Confederation, a three-branch government with a legislature, an executive branch, and a judicial branch. And then after the Philadelphia Convention, Madison took a leading role in Virginia and in other states in getting the Constitution ratified, that is, getting the states to agree to live under it. Once that was done, or in the process of doing that, he promised that if people would agree to ratify the Constitution, he would work with other Federalists in the First Congress to see to it that amendments were adopted, clarifying some of the limits on federal power, among which, of course, would be express protections for traditional English freedoms like freedom of speech, freedom of press, the right to keep and bear arms, the right not to have your house searched without a warrant, and so on. And then in the First Congress, Madison took the lead in having 12 proposed amendments sent to the states. He eventually was also going to take a central role in saying how the Constitution should be understood once it was implemented. He laid out what we now call states' rights, or strict construction approach to constitutional interpretation in the 1790s. In 1798, as I said earlier, he and Jefferson held up this notion that the states should understand that it was their duty to keep the federal government from enforcing unconstitutional and dangerous policies by standing between the citizens and the federal government if they had to. And then in 1800, his party, the Jeffersonian Republican Party, which is associated with Jefferson, but which really Madison organized, threw out, or got the people to throw out, the Federalists who had run the government for its first 12 years. And then we had the first time in world history where, by having an election, one party defeated another, and the other party peacefully came to power. Once Jefferson was president, he made his right-hand man, Madison, the Secretary of State, and it was understood that that Madison would succeed Jefferson as president. And the two of them conducted an experiment in foreign policy to see whether it would work to have economic coercion replace military coercion as an instrument of international relations. So instead of having a big navy and an army, Madison and Jefferson thought we could just tell foreign countries, look, if you don't treat us the way we want, we won't trade with you. We won't send you our rice and wheat and tobacco and so on. Ultimately, this foreign policy didn't work. And so when he was president, he ended up doing the opposite of what he and Jefferson wanted, which was to call on Congress to declare war in 1812. And then Madison led the executive branch in the War of 1812 in, I would say, a pretty incompetent way. It was only through kind of blind luck and the fact that it really wasn't worth Britain's effort to take American territory that America didn't lose a big slab of territory at the end of the War of 1812. But those are kind of the greatest hits in Madison's life. And, well, my book corrects the received wisdom about Madison in several ways. I mentioned the article about Madison's account of 1798 during the 1832 and 33 nullification crisis, which was inaccurate. Madison also is commonly called the father of the Constitution for his role in the Philadelphia Convention that wrote the Constitution. But this, I think, is inaccurate because the Virginia plan that Madison and his colleagues from Virginia proposed was really rejected. Every one of the main features beyond that he wanted to have three branches of the government, every one of the main features that Madison was most concerned with was defeated in Philadelphia Convention. And in fact, one historian, Forrest MacDonald of the University of Alabama, has gone through the records of the Philadelphia Convention and counted up and found that on the majority of votes that Madison cast in the convention, he actually was on the losing side. So calling him the father of the Constitution is just inaccurate if that were all you knew about it. But I also know, and if you read the book, you'll see, that within a month of a little more than a month after the convention ended, Madison wrote a letter to his best friend, Thomas Jefferson, and said, essentially, this Constitution is better than the Articles of Confederation, but it's going to fail within a few years. And he listed some of his favorite proposals that had been left out of it, and he said, without these, it's bound to fall apart. So he's also often credited with the Bill of Rights. I said before that Madison took the lead in the first Congress in drafting what we now call the Bill of Rights and getting Congress to send them out to the states for the ratification. But what that omits is that Madison had argued during the ratification process through which the states agreed to the new Constitution that there didn't need to be a Bill of Rights, and in fact, a Bill of Rights would be dangerous. So he didn't want to have a Bill of Rights, and finally had to agree to sponsor one because that was the alternative to being left out of Congress. If he had not made that promise, it's entirely likely that Virginia wouldn't have ratified, but it's certainly the case that he wouldn't have been elected to the first Congress. And in the first Congress, when he was bringing up this idea, we need to talk about a Bill of Rights, the other congressmen kept saying, no, we have more important things to do, like creating the executive departments and creating the federal judiciary and, you know, establishing a tax system. And then some of them wrote in their private correspondence, you know, Madison keeps bringing up this Bill of Rights thing because he's worried about his political future in Virginia, which actually was entirely true. Then I said before that there's this great inconsistency between what Madison said about the nullification issue and what his past record showed. There are several other points in the book at which, if you read kind of the other things that are out there right now, some of which are written by journalists, you know, actually there are two or three biographies of Madison that have come out in the last 3 or 4 years, but the other ones are written by journalists or people who are not expert in this area, and they all kind of adopt the standard, you know, he's the father of the Constitution, he's the father of the Bill of Rights, and the Virginia plan was a rough draft of the Constitution, and all this kind of stuff that, as I've just explained, is all untrue. So I'm very happy to have been able to try to correct the record, even if, well, it's possible that people won't be persuaded, but we'll see. We'll see. So far, it's been well received. It's been very well received, actually.
We've got about 5 minutes left in this segment. I wanted to ask you, do you consider yourself a revisionist historian, and how would you define that?
Well, that's usually a revisionist who's saying something new that you don't like. So, you know, basically any scholar will tell you, and you know this yourself, if you get two people to read the same book, they're gonna have different ways of understanding it. They're going to have different ways of describing it. So it shouldn't be surprising that two historians writing about the Constitution or Madison or you know, the moon landing or the weather are going to have different ways of saying what happened and where and when and who was responsible and that kind of thing. So I don't actually think that the phrase has any content other than it's almost always used as a negative.
Right.
But other than that, I don't know what to say. I think every historian who writes about a subject that's been written about before is going to say something different than what was said before, or else he wouldn't bother. What's the point of it?
Right, or at least why bother reading what he has to say?
I'm going to tell you a story of James Madison that's exactly what everybody else says.
Right.
I don't think that would be interesting. I don't think anybody would want to read it. I don't think anybody would want to write it. And I don't think it's really even possible.
You would probably sell a lot of school books, though.
You know, those tend to be products of committees of non-scholars.
Right. That's one of the problems. Now, well, that naturally takes us into a project you're working with Tom Woods on, the Liberty Classroom. Again, we don't have a lot of time left in this segment, but tell me what part you play in the Liberty Classroom.
Well, what Tom and I had in mind here was that kind of the standard version of American history that you get from textbooks, especially in eighth grade through high school, is just inaccurate. And so we hoped to offer people video courses in basic subjects like the U.S. to 1877, the U.S. since 1877, Western Civ to 1500, Western Civ since 1500, basic Austrian economics, where actually Brian McClanahan, another historian, and I are currently working on adding a course on American constitutional history and so on, from which you're going to get a take that's actually grounded in primary sources and not just, as I said before, a kind of feel-good or politically correct account by non-scholarly committee members. I'm actually really thrilled about it. As said, so far we've had very good feedback about the courses. People who have signed up are really happy with it.
The obvious thing with these Liberty Classroom is what a tremendous tool that it's going to be for homeschoolers. But I think above and beyond that, you know, if I was just wanting to learn this stuff, or if I was just starting to find out that there was this other history that has not been taught by the mainstream schools and so forth, if I wanted to learn this stuff, that is exactly the direction I would go, because it seems to me that it's just so convenient. You know, you can learn on your own time. You can use audio files, video files. Plus, you guys do live lectures or live interactions in some way?
Yes, actually, for people who are interested, you and I are speaking on August 15th, 2012, and tomorrow Liberty Classroom is going to be having an interactive session. The three American historians are going to be doing an online video session to which, you know, people who are signed up for Liberty Classroom can tune in, and you can pose questions, and we'll answer them, you know, instantaneously. And this is a feature of the service that comes up about once a month. So besides that, there's also a feature of the service on the website where, if you want, you can post written questions at any time, and we answer them usually within a day.
Mm-hmm.
So. It's highly interactive. What we really hope to do is to encourage people to read beyond the lectures themselves, and we are happy to answer questions about readings or about things about suggested readings in particular topics, or about corrections or quibbles you may have or want concerning things you've read and so on. So it's really very enjoyable feature for me as one of the instructors, and I know that, again, people who are have purchased the service are very happy with that, too. Maybe I should say that the website is libertyclassroom.com.
And we'll provide links to there, too, from badquaker.com, so that people can get right over to it. Let's take a quick break here. We'll stick some commercials in, and Kevin and I can stand up and stretch our legs, and we'll be right back with more of this interview with Kevin Gutzman.
Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards. Hi, this is Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker from BadQuaker.com. I listen to the Freedom Fiends live Sunday night on the Liberty Radio Network. That's LRN.FM. And you can hear the Freedom Fiends 24/7 on their streaming feed at FreedomFiends.com. That's FreedomFiends.com.
And thanks for sticking with me through the break. I'm with Kevin Gutzman here on BadQuaker.com podcast. And we were talking about Kevin's latest book, James Madison and the Making of America. Kevin's other books are The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, Virginia's American Revolution, and Who Killed the Constitution. And then, in addition to that, there's a huge body of work that's out there, and I'll provide some links for you over at BadQuaker.com. If you want to learn some more about Kevin and his work, you can visit his homepage and various places where his work appears by following those links at BadQuaker.com. Kevin, again, thanks for being on the show with me.
Happy to.
I meant to tease you earlier about being a recovering attorney.
Well, I suppose it's one day at a time.
what type of law were you in, if you don't mind me
asking?
Well,
I was an attorney for about a minute. I worked at a general practice firm, so kind of soup to nuts. I think we did everything except for divorces and slip and falls.
So. Well.
You wouldn't have seen ads for, if you get in a car crash, come to us on TV, but other than that, we probably didn't.
Well, attorneys take a lot of heat in the general discussion, but in all honesty, most attorneys are, they're a part of the market. They're not most attorneys that you encounter. I know the government employs a lot of attorneys, but most attorneys are, privately employed or employed in a corporation or a firm of some kind, and they're not monsters. They don't have cloven hooves, and they don't have to hide horns on their head or anything. They're actual people.
Well, I can vouch for that in most cases.
In most cases. I always have to put a caveat in there.
That's right.
I have found articles on the internet going all the way back to 2004 and even 2001 where you were talking about states breaking up or states splitting and possibility earlier on. Well, not as back as far as 2001, but you talked about nullification before it was hip and cool, before all the other kids were talking about it. What were you seeing back in 2004 and 2001 that was inspiring you to think about those things?
Well, the piece you're talking about from 2001 was about the idea again that American states are just, many of them are just too populous for Republican government. That is, if you have 30 million people living in one polity, shouldn't be surprised if an investment banker's wife ends up being one of the senators, or a world famous movie actor ends up being the governor, and so it was in that moment that I decided I would throw out the notion that, well, maybe we ought to subdivide these places. Maybe Northern California, the LA area, Central California, there ought to be more than one state there. Maybe Texas, which came into the Union on the understanding that it could be subdivided into five, and which actually is five different regions, should be divided into five different states. What's the point of this? The point is that now, if you're the average Joe or Jane, really you know that it's impossible for you to have much effect on your government in one of these large states, certainly on the federal government, it's impossible for you to aspire to one of the top political offices and so on. And if we had a more human scale of life, then we could expect, I think, people to be more involved in their Republican life. So that was what appealed to me about the idea, and I still think it's a good idea. And of course, the population now is even larger than then, so it makes even more sense. What do San Diego and San Francisco have in common? Well, not a lot. What do Amarillo and Beaumont have in common? Well, not a lot. So El Paso and Dallas, what do they have in common? So I think that America could benefit by this. And I might even go so far as to argue that it makes sense for the United States to be divided into multiple regions. As long as they're going to have peaceful relations with each other, I think it would make a ton of sense. Besides that factor of more possibility of fulfilling one's Republican aspirations, if you have a lower level of government handling most of your political problems, people are going to end up with government that's more to their liking. That is, as an Army brat, I've lived in Hawaii and Idaho, California, Louisiana, Virginia, Michigan, Connecticut, Kentucky, and I can tell you, people in different parts of the country are actually different. They want different kinds of government. So the beauty of the federal system that was the original system in America was that you could have that. If people in Massachusetts wanted one kind of government and people in Louisiana wanted a different kind, hey, more power to them. Why not let them do it? So thanks for reminding me of this, actually. It is one optimistic note that one can strike concerning our current political situation, which otherwise is pretty grim, I think.
Well, let me kind of push the discussion into that direction. This is the common question that everybody's asking everyone right now. What do you see coming at us in the next few years? How do you perceive? I don't think there's much question that the U.S. is going to go through some dramatic changes due to its overextension militarily, financially, in every other way. Do you have any crystal ball looks into the future for us?
Well, I've been telling people for years now, I think we have a choice. The empire can end the way the British Empire ended, or it can end the way the Soviet Empire ended. You know, the British decided about 1960 that governing Kenya and the islands in the Caribbean and various remote possessions in Asia and so on just didn't make any sense, and so they basically let all those places have their independence. On the other hand, the Soviet Union went completely belly up in the early 1990s, and suddenly all of Eastern Europe was free, and people in Russia are still facing declining prospects. So we could do it one way or the other, but I think our fiscal situation means we're just not going to have this world-spanning empire where Americans decide which Korean rules South Korea and which brand of Muslim rules Iraq and which thug rules Libya, and who even thinks this matters? I mean, you know, so not only is it impossible to finance, but it's just nonsensical. It's entirely a matter of inertia, as I understand it, that we ended up with this Cold War military and diplomatic posture, even though the Soviet Union is now more than 20 years in the past. So I tend to think probably we're going to end up going the way of the Soviet Union and just having a financial meltdown that means all the troops suddenly aren't paid wherever they happen to live. But it's possible we could do it the other way, and I'd prefer the other way, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in the hope business, so I don't have any positive prognostication. It does look to me, though, as if it's obviously impossible to fund.
Mm-hmm. You said an interesting thing in the last segment about Madison and Jefferson's ideas of trying to control foreign entities through the use of essentially, saying who can trade with the U.S. and who can't according to how you behave.
Right.
And we've kind of got a morphed version of that now. It's just that we have a big stick to whack people with at the same time. But it didn't work out, you know, for Madison and Jefferson, as you said.
No, it was a complete flop.
And what I keep saying we, I'm not up there in Washington doing these things, but But the powers that be in Washington seem to be trying to use, you know, the power of the American market as a bribe and as a punishment, while at the same time using the threat of American occupation and the threat of aircraft carriers, you know, floating off your coast and everything. We're trying to use both those at the same time, and it seems as well, I don't know if there's a better word I can think of other than silly. You know, it just doesn't seem like a person sat down and thought this out and said, yeah, this should work. This is a good idea. Let's try this.
Well, oh boy. Obviously, it didn't work for Madison. That is, beginning in the 1780s, he had the idea that, you know, I'd like to have, and this was part of the whole intellectual structure that went into the American Revolution. We shouldn't have standing armies. We don't want to have all this authority in the executive. If you have a big army, you have to pay high taxes, and besides that, the executive can use that to cow the legislature, and you end up with more secrecy in your government, and it's less accountable, and so on. So Madison's solution was, well, okay, then what we can do is we'll just not have any army. We'll, you know, we can get rid of all the taxes, get rid of the army, and in case some foreign country behaves in a hostile way toward us, we'll tell them, again, we're not going to sell you rice or tobacco or wheat or any of these things we sell people. And during the World Wars that were the wars of the French Revolution and Napoleon, the French and the British were in a kind of death struggle. They weren't going to be cowed by some bumpkin country across the Atlantic that said, you know, you're going to have less access to tobacco if you don't have the military posture we want. So ultimately what this resulted in was the British burning down the White House and burning down the Capitol, and it was a complete debacle. So, you know, you see a lot of people with the same attitude about foreign policy now. Some people say, well, we don't need to have any army at all. How do we know that? Well, because having an army is a bad thing. You have to pay taxes. You're going to have secrecy in the government. It's the same kind of reasoning. Because I'd rather not have any military at all, therefore we don't need one. So my own feeling is, of course, we have a very adventurous foreign policy, but that's not to say that the world is a nice place and we should have no defense at all. So I guess I sympathize with Madison's goals, but I do think it was bass-ackwards reasoning. Should have looked at the world and decided, okay, what are our actual needs here, instead of deciding what he wished the country's needs were and then pretending those were its needs.
And I should clarify, because some of my listeners might be a little confused at this point. I've got a pretty large audience. Well, I shouldn't say large. I should say a pretty high percentage of my audience are anarcho-capitalists. Some are actual anarchists. Some are, you know, libertarian minarchists. We've got a pretty wide variety of listeners.
Right.
So you, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you probably wouldn't consider yourself an anarchist. I would assume that you are, that you would like some type of minimal government.
Right. Well, I'm a Jeffersonian, and the reason is I don't want to speak Mandarin. I think, you know, I don't want to go the way of Tibet. I mean, that's that's a case study in anarchy, and the end result was they're now part of China. So on one hand, I, of course, am entirely sympathetic with the idea that government is rapacious and it wants to grab your liberty, but you know, Madison said, what is government but the clearest of all reflections on human nature? In other words, it may be a curse, but the alternative to a minimal amount of government is a terrible situation. So I think that the only solution to this problem, well, there's no ultimate solution to the problem. People have to be involved in the government, or else the government will grow out of hand, and then you end up with you end up with drones flying over your town, or, you know, red light cameras. No, I sympathize with the goals, I mean, with the impulse, but I think it's just not reality.
Let me throw an idea at you, or not an idea. Let me throw a framework at you and see what you think about this. I've got about 5 minutes before the break, so I don't know if I can get this in its entirety or not. But I kind of see if you could look down on history from above, so to speak, and you could see the ancient kings as city states developing and kings developing, and then sort of a new type of thing came along with empires, and they popped up in spots temporarily, and they would rise and fall and rise and fall, but there was sort of this formula of empires that was consistent for a while. And then the Romans came along and kind of made a weird version of their own and sort of changed the formula, and it lasted a little longer than some of the others, but not as long as some. And then as far as Europe was concerned, with the Catholic Church sort of provided a model to hold things as a central state, but in a very new way, like had never been available before. And then around 1600, I think a new type of government began to develop with the invention of corporations and this sort of marriage between, the people were moving, as at least Europe was moving away from the medieval forms of mercantilism and more towards this version of mercantilism where it was actually corporations rather than guilds, and it was authorized or married to the government. And I kind of think from about 1600 to about 1900 there was this growing phase where this latest incarnation of the state came into its maturity about 1900. And for about the last 100 years, we've been watching worldwide this version of the state in its different forms. U.S. and what's even the European Union is still kind of following this new pattern. And I kind of suspect that this whole pattern, with centralized banking and all the flaws that come with it, and the military. I kind of think that there are flaws built into this process, and we're about to see a system-wide change, not just a change just in America or just in Europe, but an actual morphing of the state into another thing altogether. I'm not exactly sure what that will look like. Now, does that sound like complete craziness to you, or can you also see some kind of pattern like that?
Well, one caveat to what you said is that you made the western part of Europe central to the story of the Middle Ages, and of course the western part of Europe was the outback. The center of Europe was the Byzantine Empire. So I don't see that period in quite the same way as you're describing it. But ultimately, sure, you can certainly see a kind of decline of the form of society that Western countries have had going on right now. The idea that this necessarily means it's coming to an end, however, I think is a little bit too optimistic. It's kind of like saying, we'd be better off without armies, therefore we don't need one, or we'd be better off without a rapacious government, therefore we can have no government. I think there are just some elements of the human condition that are unpleasant, and sometimes in history you end up at a point at which things aren't pleasant.
Mm.
So, yeah, I certainly sympathize with the idea, again, that, Western government has gotten to the point of growing apparently ineluctably and infinitely until we're all bound for a kind of Greek scenario. But I don't think that means we can necessarily avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
I actually look at our current political, financial, cultural situation, and I don't see how we can avoid it. I honestly don't see how the American political system is going to avert a meltdown like the one that's been happening in Greece, with the significant distinction that there's no Germany to back us up, right?
Yeah.
We're just going to fall flat on our faces, our collective face, I guess. And
mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean then that suddenly we'll have a decentralized polity again, or we're going to have a limited central government again. I would expect a military state instead, but maybe not. I don't know.
Well,
fortunately, I'm a historian. I don't have to have a good answer to that question.
You're not a futurist.
That's right. My book's about Madison, not about Obama or Romney.
Let's take another break here. Let me save our file, and We'll be right back, folks. Stick with us through the commercial break. We'll be right back very shortly.
Hi, folks. Ben Stone here from BadQuaker.com. I want to tell you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, they have video files, audio files, and you can participate in discussions online and in the discussion boards. These audio files are in MP3 format, so you can download them and take them with you. You can listen to them on your drive to and from work or any time that's convenient for you. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes they don't get the real story in government-approved schools and government-approved history. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers, but it's also good for anybody who wants to learn about liberty while avoiding state propaganda. Take this course, and Tom Woods and his team will equip you with one of the very best tools the liberty movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. Now, who else are you going to find at Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom? Kevin Gutzman, the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, which is on my list of books, plus lots of other noted educators and students that will help guide you to your understanding of history and Austrian economics. So what is this kind of an education worth to you and your family? Well, at Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for around $8 a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that will be added later in the future, the discussion forums, the optional live sessions, and reading suggestions. Now, how do you do this? Folks, go to badquaker.com. Click on the banner on the right-hand column where you see the ad for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. By using the link at badquaker.com, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help keep badquaker.com on the internet. Thank you very much, folks.
Okay, thanks for sticking with us through the commercial. And again, the guest on badquaker.com today is Kevin Gutzman, author of James Madison and the Making of America, author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, Virginia's American Revolution, and Who Killed the Constitution, in addition to lots of articles and lots of other stuff. Kevin, again, thanks for coming on the show with me. What we were talking about during the break there, you had mentioned some people really have an optimistic view of the future based on some of the technology and some of the positive things that we see, but just because something's new doesn't mean that it's exactly going to make our world all happy and butterflies.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. You know, you hear people like Newt Gingrich who've always had an eye toward technological, medical, political changes that are going on, and seem always to extrapolate happy endings. You know, we're all going to be healthier, wealthier, freer. But as I was just observing to you, in the last couple of years, we've seen social media, cell phones, and other of the latest technological gizmos used all over the Middle East to bring the Muslim Brotherhood to power. So I don't think necessarily that it follows that because there's change, it's going to be positive. I'm a historian. I tend to be rather more skeptical.
Yeah, I think when the whole thing started sweeping across North Africa, and there was all this optimism that, oh, this is going to be really great, this is going to be really good. And I have a good friend that's over there, without getting into any real detail, but he works private security and in very dangerous places, and he's probably listening to this. But he told me at the time, he said, this is not good. The instability that you're seeing here is going to end up in military dictatorships worse than the ones that were gone, that were getting kicked out.
Well, you know, the funny thing about that is it's been 15 or 20 years ago now that Algeria had a first round of elections. They had a constitution, since Algeria had been a French colony, they had a constitution somewhat like the French, and so they have a first round of elections, and then they have a second round, and the winners of the second round end up in the parliament. They choose a president and so on. Well, they had their first round of elections, and they saw that something like 80% of the candidates who were going to win were Muslim Brotherhood types, and so the army canceled the elections. The U.S. and the European countries never complained that the Algerian army had done this, right? And still today, you don't hear anybody saying, we insist that Algeria have elections. The reason was that we saw who was going to come to power, but for some reason, I guess stupid stupidity, I'm not sure, ignorance, or maybe malevolence, who knows. But for some reason, this time around, people in the Obama administration thought, yeah, well, anything's better than Mubarak. Even though Mubarak has been reliably friendly to the United States, it's bound to be better if it's democratic. And, well, I suppose we're going to find out within the next 5 years whether that was really true, but I think we have good ground for doubting it.
Let me take you in a completely different direction here. You made some statements not long ago, and it really kind of shocked people on the left, and it shocked people on the right, because you didn't follow the line like you were supposed to. You know, in the case of District of Columbia versus Heller, which was basically a court battle asking if the District of Columbia's gun ban, a handgun ban, if that law was constitutional. And now, what I'm going to say something that some of my listeners are going to be a little bit shocked by, but you took a position that was absolutely consistent with the historical, with the actual position the Constitution stands on. You took a position consistent with that, which is not consistent with the right or the left's position, and it's certainly not consistent with the outcome of that decision. And I would say that took a lot of that took a lot of guts. But you stood on, you're saying basically, and I'll let you explain yourself, but you're saying basically, look, if you're going to go by the Constitution, you have to go by the Constitution, not this imaginary one you make up in your mind and you believe was there.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, Tom Woods and I wrote a book called Who Killed the Constitution, and in the appendix we include the Bill of Rights, including the preamble to the Bill of Rights. And the preamble to the Bill of Rights says that the reason that these amendments are being recommended to the states is that during the ratification process, people have become concerned that the limits of federal authority aren't clearly enough delineated. So the entire purpose of the Bill of Rights was to limit the power of the federal government. This is a fact that was recognized by the federal courts for over a century after the Bill of Rights was ratified, and most famously in a case called Barron versus Baltimore in 1833, Chief Justice John Marshall, who never in any other significant constitutional case held against federal authority, Chief Justice Marshall in the unanimous court said, Bill of Rights is a limitation on the federal government. It's not a mechanism that can be used by federal judges to veto state laws. And you might think, well, what does that have to do with Heller? And the answer is that the Heller case was about a gun ban that was adopted by the local government of the District of Columbia, which, for purposes of local self-government, is analogous to a state. It's not exactly a state, but you have to treat it as a state when it comes to the government of the people who live there. So my point was, in relation to the Heller arguments, that if you understand the Bill of Rights as a limitation solely on states, and that these questions of local self-government are left to local self-government, not to federal judges, then the Second Amendment was not a limitation on Congress acting as the local government of the people who live in the District of Columbia, and therefore, if they wanted to regulate guns in that way or whatever way, they could do so. In fact, there's no alternative in D.C. to having Congress regulate gun ownership. There has to be somebody who can say, we're not going to have severely retarded people owning guns, we're not going to have violent felons owning guns, we're not going to have people, you know, we're going to have some kind of regulation of guns. And now, on the other hand, that's not to say that I like the idea of gun bans, I'm not saying that, but the issue is, where is this question decided in our federal system? And my answer almost always is, well, not in federal courts, and certainly the Bill of Rights is not intended as a limitation on local governments, in this case, the Congress acting as the local government of D.C. Now, one argument that people have made, and I'm sure that people who have been miseducated by going to law school in your audience are going to be thinking this. Yeah, I know this because I went to law school before I went back for a PhD and got an education. But people who are going to be listening to this are going to be thinking, well, the 14th Amendment, which was supposedly ratified in 1868, made these provisions of the Bill of Rights applicable by federal courts against the state governments. And all I have to say about that is it's just not true. I mean, nobody ever came up with that idea until the second decade of the 20th century. And this is an idea that was invented beginning in the second decade of the 20th century by left-wing judges so that they could have a mechanism for vetoing state laws they didn't like. That's why we've come to have a situation in America in which most of the most interesting political decisions are made, at least domestic political decisions are made, by federal judges. It has no basis in the 14th Amendment's actual ratification. It's simply a mechanism that was invented by federal courts 5 decades and more after the bill, after the 14th Amendment was adopted. And if you understand what the idea of incorporation is, it doesn't even make any sense. What it says is essentially that the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, which says that no person may be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process, means that you have all kinds of rights, like the right not to have a church be established, or the right not to have your house searched without a warrant, or, you know, it's nonsensical to think that this purely procedural due process clause includes all these substantial rights, and evidence that it's not supposed, it wasn't supposed to mean that, can be found in extensive debates in Congress within 10 years of the 14th Amendment's adoption over the question whether there should be an amendment to the Constitution to make the principle of separation of church and state enforceable by the federal government against the states. If the 14th Amendment had been included to incorporate the Establishment Clause, there would have been no reason to have months-long debates in Congress over whether to have a provision added to the Constitution that said that states couldn't infringe on the freedom of religion. It just doesn't even make any sense. So, yes, you're right. I took this position in Heller. It was not what gun rights people were saying. It's not what the anti-gun rights people were saying either, because they never would come out and say, oh, yeah, well, the incorporation doctrine's bunk, and so D.C. Local government can regulate gun ownership. They think the incorporation doctrine is wonderful because they've used it to veto all kinds of local laws just because left-wingers don't like them.
I see this pretty regularly with people who embrace the Constitution as the, you know, as the answer to all of life's woes. And they always kind of have this thing in their mind, like there was this moment in their mind where the government, where the D.C. government followed the Constitution, everything was happy. And for the individual person, that might have been the 80s, or that might have been the 60s, or the 50s, or the 1900, or whatever. But in reality, and correct me if your opinion is different, in reality, today, there's very little actual limits to the federal powers in the, as far as the government in Washington, D.C., the way it functions today. The only limits are really, you know, what can they get away with? It's not really constitutionally based in any way, is it?
No, not at all. Actually, when I published my first book, which is called The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, and is a history of the federal constitution from before its adoption down to the present, I did over 150 radio appearances, and I did speaking engagements, and I, you know, did a lot of magazine interviews and that kind of thing. And typically, when I would make a public appearance or talk on the radio, and they'd take calls and that kind of thing, people would say to me, "Well, you know, okay, the Constitution is increasingly ignored. We know that liberal judges act that way." And I would say, well, okay, you know, if you know the liberal judges act that way, you know something. I'm not saying you don't know anything, but it's not only liberals and it's not only judges. So that's why Tom Woods and I wrote Who Killed the Constitution. The point of that book is to show that it's Congress, it's the executive, it's the judiciary, it's both parties. They just pretend the Constitution doesn't exist. And we, you know, if we only can agree among ourselves that this means we have more power, what do you know? We have more power. So over time, the president nowadays makes war without asking Congress. Congress, you know, Speaker Pelosi was asked what in the Constitution authorizes you to adopt Obamacare, and she says, ha, 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 you've got to be kidding, ha, ha, ha. And the federal courts veto any state law they don't like and decide who's going to get Florida's presidential electors in the 2000 election. You know, they intervene where they don't have to. There was no reason why the Supreme Court had to decide that. The Florida government was going to come down with the decision of who got the state's electors, as the Constitution says is supposed to happen. So the whole thing is completely without any warrant in the Constitution. And if you read my book, James Madison and the Making of America, you will see that Madison, in explaining the Constitution and the ratification process in 1787-88, including helping to write the Federalist and then giving extensive speeches in the Virginia Ratification Convention, and then in 1791 in Congress when they were arguing over Hamilton's bank bill, in 1798 when they were arguing over the Sedition Act, as I mentioned earlier, and then in the very last act he took as president in 1817, in all of these contexts, he explained how the Constitution was to be interpreted, not just what it meant in the particular controversy he was addressing, but how it should generally be interpreted. And he was consistent across all those years, but what's consistent now is basically the Congress, President Obama, the Supreme Court, they don't pay any attention to this. They don't basically behave as if we had a Constitution. They just think they can do whatever they want. And, of course, they do whatever they want. So, as I said earlier, we're on our way to Greece, and I don't see that we're going to be able to avoid going there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not, you know, not a happy prospect. Who was I listening to? Oh, I knew who it was. Gerald Celente uses the phrase gold, guns, and a get out of town plan or something like that. And I think he gets a little excited sometimes. Is that a polite way of saying it?
Oh, I think so.
But there's a certain amount of truth in what he's saying, that, you know, you look ahead and there can be some really trying times ahead of us, and it's really difficult to know what's going to be happening. But you were talking a minute ago about California and the possibility of dividing it into multiple states, and I'm not sure, but what something like that may be a possibility of a morphing. I know there's a, well, I know I'm not going to go into that. There's a book that's going to come out pretty soon. I'm going to have an author on and do a plug for it, so I won't go into its details, but it kind of goes into that kind of a thing. And I know in California, you know, I've lived in several different places in California, and the culture on the eastern side of the Sierras is unique to the eastern Sierras, and it's foreign from Los Angeles and San Francisco and the Central Valley as New York is, you know.
Right, sure.
And so there's a certain logicalness that, or a certain path of logic where you can see that people like that will tend to want self-governance and local governance, and they'll have a tendency to reject the big foot coming in on them from Washington. So, you know, it's not hard to see something like that. But, again, what you were saying there, that doesn't necessarily mean happy times, because there's still a massive military presence that's got to do something.
Well, there's a huge financial mess, too. That's the main thing.
Yeah. And there's going to be people who are in control of these things who are not going to want to let go of that control, and they're not going to be really pleased about any type of breakup that might attempt to spontaneously happen. So it's, you know, it's not, maybe it's not Gerald Celente's view, but I'm not sure that I can have the positive, happy time view either.
Me neither.
Well, let's give one more shout out to the Liberty Classroom before I let you get going. That is, I really think that's going to be a fantastic tool for people to be able to use, and I've personally got behind it. I've talked about it on Facebook, and I've put links on Bad Quaker to it, because I really think it's a really good tool, and I'm really pleased that you're working with Tom Woods on that, because, you know, I think you guys offset each other. You're not exactly alike with each other. There's a lot of things that you guys are different on, but that's good in the sense that you it's kind of like looking at something in stereo. You get two different views, and you can kind of make sense out of it.
Well, I hope it works that way. I think we're more alike than not alike, however.
Well, possibly it's just the maybe it's just the different tone that you take in history that gives it the nice that nice perspective. But either way, you guys work good together, and your books really reflect that harmony. And I do appreciate you coming on the show with me, and I want to extend an invitation anytime in the future. We're on Facebook together. We bump into each other now and then over there. Just drop me a note anytime you want to come back on the podcast.
Very good. Will do.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
Bye.
Okay, now that was my interview with Kevin Gutzman, and I was very happy to have him come on the show and talk about these things. It's really obvious that Kevin sees the future in a very different light than I do. And somebody might ask, well, why didn't you contradict him on this, or why didn't you correct him on that, or why didn't you? Well, that's not why I had Kevin on. I didn't have Kevin on the show so that I could attack him or try to convince him of something or try to have some kind of debate. That wasn't the purpose. It was, he's a very intelligent individual and a respected scholar, and so I wanted to give him the respect that was due to him. Now, if I were going to offer him the opportunity to come on in a debate, I would do that. Clearly, I would say, Kevin, would you like to come on and debate the prospects of anarchy or small government as opposed to no government and these things? But that was not my intent. If you want to hear me debate, I do plan on having a debate with Mark Edge from Free Talk Live on the topic of voting. So, and I'll give you updates on that as we get closer to that. I need to communicate with Mark on the topic, and we need to get the parameters set up. But I do intend to have a proper debate with Mark on that topic. So the difference here being that Mark will know that we're having a debate, and he'll know the parameters of that debate. Whereas, if I would just have sprang that on Kevin, that would have been very unfair of me. So I wanted to respect Kevin and give him the opportunity to express himself on on fair ground. So anyway, I hope you did enjoy the interview with Kevin. And be sure and get over to badquaker.com and hit those links and find out more about Kevin Gutzman. And as always, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, get over to badquaker.com. Thank you very much, folks, for listening.